Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, a topic that everybody loves to talk about because frequently we have problems sleeping or we sleep too much or it's kind of a weird thing, sleep, isn't it? That you got to sleep all these hours to function. If you don't have enough sleep, you just can't function very well. And why a certain number of hours seems to be the best. Well, a new study was released this week by the CDC study, and it shows that too much or too little sleep is tied to ill health. People who sleep fewer than 6 hours a night or more than 9 hours are more likely to be obese, according to this new government study. It's a very large study. It was released yesterday based on door-to-door surveys of 87,000 U.S. adults from 2004 through 2006, conducted by the National Center for Health Services, part of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It looked at some interesting issues about smoking, light sleepers with higher smoking rates, less physical activity, and more alcohol use. Found that obesity and other health problems in those who did not get enough sleep. We are going to be talking about elderly people who get the least sleep. What happens with people who get more than 9 hours sleep? I don't know. Sometimes more than 9 hours sleep sounds A-OK to me, although it rarely happens. We have as our guest this hour to analyze the studies, and I know we'll be getting a lot of calls because we all sleep and we all have issues with sleep at one time or another in our lives. Dr. Don Hardin is co-medical director of the Sleep Wellness Institute, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Dr. Hardin at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Dr. Hardin.
Good morning.
So is it the best advice, 7 or 8 hours?
That appears to be the case. I think most people who get 7 to 8 tend to function the best. Of course, that's a generality. There are individuals who do get less than that, who feel perfectly fine, who are not sleepy during the day. There are people who get somewhat more than that, also who feel the same way. But I'd say most adults are probably going to get 7 to 8, need 7 to 8. Probably most of us get 6 to 7, mm-hmm. Burn the candle at both ends type of thing.
Right. What is this connection? This study had as a major conclusion that people who sleep fewer than 6 or more than 9 are more likely to be obese. Why would that be?
The study made a really good point. It's kind of buried in there that this is not, we don't know that this is cause and effect or if it's a relationship. In other words, does sleeping less than that or sleeping more than that cause you to be obese, or the fact that you're obese causes you to do these other things?
Hmm.
Same thing with smoking, same thing with alcohol. We do know there's a relationship, they're linked. There can be disease entities that can link them, such as sleep apnea. If you're heavy, you snore, you stop breathing, that's going to interrupt your sleep,
mm-hmm.
and cause you to get less than, say, 7 or 8 hours of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So more than that is also a little bit more difficult to assess. We don't know if that means it's a marker for things like depression or some other reason that you would be sleeping longer hours. We do know that people who do sleep long hours, I mean, they really do sleep this, it's probably an indication of something wrong.
Hmm. If they sleep more than 9?
Right, consistently. This isn't, I've been working really hard all week long and then on Saturday I catch up. That's not the same.
Right. Can you catch up?
Sort of. You can make up, say, over about a 3 or 4 day span, what you've been missing, say over a span of several nights. But you're not going to catch up all the sleep you've ever missed.
Mm-hmm.
After about 3 or 4 nights of, so to speak, catch up sleep, you're not going to catch up anymore. Whatever was lost is just lost.
Yeah. I went through a really bad health spell a couple months ago, and I was getting about 3 hours at the most of sleep for a couple weeks, and I got to tell you, I went crazy. I really did. It was awful.
Yes, it is. And again, it's not clear from the research whether the fact that you didn't sleep well caused you to be more ill,
mm-hmm.
or the fact that you were ill and there were certain inflammatory compounds that you make, immune compounds that you make, that also promote being awake. So we don't know which one is which.
Mm-hmm.
I think the comment you made before I got on the air about sleep is strange, I mean, that's probably the best way to put it. we don't have a good grasp, a complete grasp of what sleep is for. We do know that if you don't sleep, you don't function well.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't sleep, you don't remember well. You don't learn well. So we think that sleep, one of its major functions, at least for the brain anyway, is to promote learning and memory.
Hmm. It seems like such a waste of time, though, doesn't it?
Well,
sometimes.
From an evolutionary standpoint, something about sleep is extremely important. As far as we can tell, all animals sleep, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be very brief, you know, for some organisms, maybe only an hour, maybe only 20 minutes.
Oh.
But if they don't sleep, they also don't learn. And there was elegant experiments that were presented at the last international conference on sleep that talked about teaching various kinds of things, flies and worms and rats, to learn projects. And if they didn't sleep, they didn't learn.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What's this thing about smoking? Smoking, this study shows, was highest for people who got under 6 hours of sleep, with 31% saying that they were current smokers. Those got 9 or more hours, also big puffers, with 26% smoking. What the heck is the link there?
The word for it would be it's a link. I suppose if you were a physician and you're asking just general questions about somebody's health, and they say they don't get a lot of sleep, you'd ask them, by the way, do you happen to smoke?
Mm-hmm.
You could postulate that you smoke, that's nicotine, that's a stimulant. Maybe there's something wrong with your sleep and you're real sleepy during the day and you're trying to stay awake because your sleep's being interrupted at night. It's not clear.
Mm-hmm. And what about older people, Dr. Harden? We keep hearing that the older you get, the more often you wake up to go to the bathroom or whatever, but also that you just don't seem to need as much sleep.
Certainly that the opinion on this changes with time, but current opinion is that's probably not true.
Really?
Is that the elderly don't need more sleep. They probably need it, but they can't get it. Various health issues can interfere. Like I said, bathroom trips, pain from joints, other health issues, perhaps monetary concerns. You know, things like this can interrupt sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Also, for the elderly, there tends to be a phenomenon called sleep phase advance, where people, when they get elderly, they tend to fall asleep much earlier in the day, and they tend to wake up much earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to mimic what people do as infants. They fall asleep early and they get up to the crack of dawn.
Right.
Or earlier.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And quite the opposite true for teenagers. Yeah. Shed some light on that group of people.
Absolutely. That's called phase delay. There's a natural biologic urge for those people who are in their teens to stay up late and get up late. That doesn't mean you have to obey that.
You can't. You got to go to school, right?
That makes it really difficult.
Right. They should probably completely change hours and make those, you know, 11 o'clock start and 7 o'clock finish.
It would fit their biologic needs better. I'm not sure if it fit the social needs so much.
Yeah.
But it definitely would be more in tune with their biorhythm.
Mm-hmm. So why is it we don't know at this point the purpose of sleep? You've talked about that we need it for learning, we need it for health. Why don't we know why we really need it?
Well, you know, first postulates, well, I guess it really goes back to the fact that the research into sleep is fairly new.
Hmm.
This is only the only intense research of this been going on, say, since the early 1900s, and really recognizing disease states maybe in the only last 40 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And the tools that we had to investigate it weren't developed until later, things like the EEG and knowing that sleep is staged. There are various stages of sleep, light sleep, deep sleep, dream sleep. These weren't recognized until much later. So our first task was, what is sleep? I mean, what is a normal sleep first before we can figure out what's not right about it? And we spent a lot of time trying to figure out what it really does, what it is, what it's characterized by.
Mm-hmm. I like to go to sleep. Do you like to go to sleep?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
And that tends to define adults. Adults really do want to go to sleep, and kids usually really don't.
Right. I know.
And you get children. I mean, that's one of the markers for kids, is that children definitely, especially once you get around four or five years of age to about age 12, they're probably one of the most active groups of people there are. So when, you know, they wake up early and go all day long, usually don't nap, and when they go to sleep, it's lights out and done, and I'll see you the next morning.
Right.
They fall into deep sleep extremely quickly. So when you get a child who is at that age group and they're taking naps, you wonder about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's amazing to me, Dr. Hardin, that these, as you are director of Sleep Wellness Institute, that there are so many of these now that people obviously in this country have an enormous number of sleep problems.
Well, it's probably always been there. And like, as you said, we just now are recognizing that this is something wrong, or that it even has anything to do with sleep. Take, for instance, high blood pressure.
Mm.
When I was in training, when we had somebody who would come in the hospital and be presented to us as residents, this person had difficult to control hypertension, we would spend inordinate amounts of time looking at their heart, looking at their kidneys, looking at some rare tumor, some sort of reason why this person had high blood pressure that was difficult to control.
Mm-hmm.
When probably all along these people were snoring.
Really?
And we just didn't ask. We didn't know.
Huh.
And now we do. And so folks who are having two, three medications to control their high blood pressure, one of the first questions you ought to ask is, are you overweight and do you snore? Do you stop breathing? That's probably a contributor to the high blood pressure, or maybe the cause altogether.
Hmm. So what do you do about it?
Treat the sleep apnea. Hmm. And if that happens, usually the blood pressure will fall within a span of about 6 months.
Hmm.
Or, you know, knock on wood, it may completely disappear.
Mm-hmm. And the cause of that is just, do you have to do other things to the nose or the mouth to make sure that those passages are open to treat that fully?
There's various treatments that are available. One of the most common is called CPAP, a pressure device that you wear with a mask on your nose or on your nose and mouth.
Hmm.
And it puts a pressure head up against those structures, and it pushes the throat open, keeps you from snoring, keeps you from stopping breathing. When you have these episodes of sleep apnea, you stop breathing, your body thinks it's under attack.
Hmm.
And when it thinks it's under attack, it secretes a hormone called adrenaline or epinephrine. And it gets you ready for a fight or a flight or do something.
Hmm.
And part of the thing that that hormone does is raise your blood sugar, and it also raises your blood pressure.
Hmm.
That's what it's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if all night long you're stopping breathing, and all night long you get these surges of adrenaline, eventually the heart and brain, if they could talk, would just say, oh, never mind, just leave the blood pressure up then.
Oh, interesting. Let's welcome phone calls. I know we're going to have a ton of them on this. We're talking about sleep, our conversation prompted by a study that came out yesterday from the CDC showing that people who sleep fewer than 6 hours a night or more than nine are more likely to be obese, according to this study. It is, according to the news report, one of the largest to show a link between irregular sleep and big bellies. The study also linked light sleepers to higher smoking rates, less physical activity, and more alcohol use. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Milwaukee is 414-227-2050, 227-2050. Our email, if you'd like to send one of those, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our guest is Dr. Don Hardin. He is co-medical director of the Sleep Wellness Institute, and we welcome your phone calls. I'm sure, you know, eventually once they get ringing here, we'll have quite a few of them. Before we start taking the calls, we want to remind you that Ira Flatow, who's the host of Talk of the Nation Science Friday, is coming to Milwaukee May 16 for a live national broadcast of his program, and you are invited to join us at the Milwaukee Public Museum May 16 from 1 to 3 for the show. Stay for for a reception to meet Ira Flatow and members of the Science Friday team. The tickets are $20 and will include admission to the museum, to the radio broadcast, and a reception with, we might add, refreshments. Later that day, a VIP dinner at Mater's German Restaurant in downtown Milwaukee with Ira Flatow. And Joy Cardine will be there, Ben Marins. I'll be there. Tickets for the buffet dinner are $50 each. And then on Thursday, May 15, we are teaming up with Discovery World Museum for their family night activities, including museum tours, special demonstrations, and movies. And the highlight will be a presentation given by Ira Flatow entitled Catalysts of Creativity, From Movie Stars to Michael Jackson. Tickets $15 for adults and $10 for children up to 17. So if you'd like information about all three events, plus how to receive a souvenir T-shirt, it's on our website, WPR.org, or for tickets, call 414-227-2047, 414-227-2047. I'm Kathleen Dunn. To your calls about sleep in just a moment, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Don Harden, who is co-medical director of the Sleep Wellness Institute, their web is sleepwellandlive.com, sleepwellandlive.com. And we're welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. CJ from Stevens Point, our first caller, doctor. Hi, CJ.
Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm concerned about a little 3.5-year-old grandson who goes to bed at about 8 o'clock at night, wakes up almost every single night about midnight, and stays awake and plays. He does. He's not unhappy. He stays awake sometimes until 5 in the morning.
Oh, my.
And he doesn't try and climb out of his bed. He just talks about his toys and plays. And I'm concerned that this child is not getting enough sleep.
How do the parents know that he's awake from midnight to 5?
Because my son is very in tune. He's awake also. His wife has started wearing earplugs so that she can go to work in the morning, and my son happens to be a stay-at-home dad.
And does he... Well, part of the thing is that, I would be worried about getting enough sleep. Chances are he probably is. It's just not at the times that you want him to. Mm-hmm. If he's asleep from 8 to midnight, he's probably... I mean, otherwise he behaves normally during the day, as far as you can tell.
Yeah, as far as we can tell, he's fine. He does not nap.
Then he's getting sleep somewhere else. He has to. But to function, he must be getting sleep somewhere else in the day. But this midnight to 5, you wonder about things that would promote that. Not only, say for instance, not only maybe dad noticing that he's awake, is he talking with him? Is he
reading? No. They never go near him because they don't want to encourage this.
Good.
They never go near him.
That would probably, if you've already done some simple things, like don't try and promote this wake behavior, and developmentally he seems to be fine in every other way, then it would be worthwhile probably to see a child sleep specialist on this. Okay. There's some things they may want to do, say if he snores or if he has large tonsils. You worry about things like sleep apnea for his age group. They may be able to do some things called actigraphy, which is a measurement that you can do at home that measures the amount of, roughly speaking, the amount of wake and sleep that you are getting. So you can not only get a direct measure or a fairly good measure of how much sleep is he getting, but also when.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Something like that might be desirable.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate this.
Thanks, CJ.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Brian from Milwaukee next. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good morning. Interesting topic. I just wanted to get the doctor's opinion. I'm a firefighter in an urban department. We have a crazy work schedule. We work 24-hour shift on and then 48 hours off. On the 24-hour shift, usually we get spotty sleep. On average, I've heard in the past referred to firefighters live on average about 10 years less than other Americans. A lot of it's the sleep deprivation, the adrenaline shots to your heart in the middle of the night.
Mm.
I've sometimes been able to equate it to friends of mine when they were in their child-rearing years, when they had the infants and they had to get up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning a couple of times throughout the night, taking care of the newborn babies, that the next day they're just washed out. I mean, that's how a lot of us are. You sometimes might lose a total of 4 hours of sleep, take an hour or 2 hour nap the next day. But over your lifetime, you never really regain all of this. I guess I wanted to know his opinion, 25, 30 years of this. What do you think this is doing to our bodies?
What, and let me just ask, why do you guys have that kind of schedule?
Well, you know, it's actually it's a cost-effective measure for taxpayers. You need 24-hour round-the-clock protection, obviously.
Right.
With working that schedule, we work equivalent to 56 hours a week.
Hmm.
So, you know, if we went to a 40-hour week, they would end up having to almost hire about another third of the size of the fire departments around the nation.
Mm-hmm.
I have to confess, I'm not familiar with the statistics on firefighters, but I can say there would be sort of a similar kind of situation, say, between residents and physicians in training and being on call and being on duty, and that clearly they've shown that the longer you stay awake, the longer you're forced to be active, and not only that, the longer you're being forced to make critical decisions, the more likely you are to be prone to error, and that's pretty well known. And you would ask, what's the long-term consequence of this? I would think it would actually be, what's the short-term consequence? Certainly your job involves, you know, life risking behavior, and, you know, you're putting your life on the line, and I'd worry about the longer you're being forced to stay awake,
Right. So maybe you think there ought to be some kind of examination of these working hours for doctors, for firefighters, for...
Again, I'm not familiar with firefighters, but I am familiar with residents, and many states have enacted legislation or have contemplated legislation that limits the amount of hours that physicians in training can be on duty.
Yeah, that seems to make sense.
Yeah, and our hours are limited, too. The maximum we could ever work is 48 hours in any given 72. So, you know, I'm sure they've looked at it from that standpoint also. I just physiologically, I just wonder, you know, in the back of my mind, what this has done over the years. So, but thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, Brian. It's a job with an incredible amount of stress, too.
Yeah, you worry about things. Certainly there have been lots of studies done. There was some very simple ones done from Canada and from the United States where they looked at things like automobile accidents. And the one experiment was simply keep people up longer and longer, set them behind a simulator, and say your only job is to watch out for somebody that's going to cut you off. Hmm. That's the only thing that's going to happen in the simulation. And typically you start losing sleep, you start braking way too late, you know, running into the person that just cut you off, or you make the other error. People would drive along and be on an expressway, and suddenly they break in the middle of the expressway, and the directors would ask the person, why did you do that? And they said, well, that person cut me off. They said, who? There was nobody there.
Oh, my gosh.
So you can make errors of judgment
in
either direction when you're sleep-deprived. And they looked, and there was a Canadian study where they simply looked at the time change around Central Daylight Savings Time. And the number of fatal accidents, not even just accidents in general, but the fatal accidents dropped dramatically in the fall when you gain an hour of sleep for about 2 days, and then it came back to where it was before.
Oh, my.
And in the spring, it dramatically rose for about 2 days when you lost an hour of sleep.
Huh.
Just, so simply 1 hour of sleep seems to have led to or saved lives.
Hmm. Pat from Green Bay, hi.
Hi. I have a question regarding estrogen and sleep. It seems as though a number of my friends who have entered menopause immediately go into a situation where they have difficulty sleeping. My OBGYN commented that he felt the estrogen affected the rapid eye movements needed for deep sleep. And I'm just wondering, should we just give up and assume that we will not sleep after we have a reduction in estrogen? Or should we continue estrogen replacement therapy as a means of sleeping?
No pun intended, that is one of the hottest topics in the field of sleep right now, is menopausal-related sleep issues. And the current opinion, that is at this year, so take that for what it's worth, the opinion this year is that menopause in and of itself doesn't appear to be a cause for any single sleep issue other than hot flashes. That one's known and pretty obvious. If you're uncomfortable and hot like that, then it's going to wake you up and make you difficult to fall back to sleep. But otherwise, it appears that all the rest of the issues that have to do with sleep, the insomnias, the sleep apnea, things like that, may have more to do with other medical problems, and that it looks as if it's menopausal-related when maybe it's not. It may be age-related, period. Or other medical problems, period, thyroid disease, arthritis, lung problems, heart problems, sleep apnea problems appear to be more prone with women once they get to be above a certain age. And again, it tends to be around the time of menopause and beyond. As far as we can tell right this moment, there is no big link between estrogen and sleep issues. There are lots of articles that suggest or hint at that kind of a link, but none that have been proven, or to put it another way, there have been just as many articles to contradict it.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Pat. Mark is next from DePere. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hello.
I'd like to send a word of encouragement to anybody listening who thinks they may have sleep apnea and is considering having the test, because I've had my sleep machine for about 4 years now. After having it for about 2 days, I felt like I had been on vacation.
Oh.
And after having it for about 2 weeks, I felt 15 or 20 years younger.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it made a remarkable difference in my life. And my follow-up visit to my doctor showed that all my blood chemistry had greatly improved. And I'm convinced that this was one reason why my father died at an early age.
Absolutely. We think this went either unrecognized or, quite frankly, people of my generation and older, they thought it was funny. You know, Uncle Joe snoring in the corner again.
Yeah.
And with surges in adrenaline, drops in oxygen, causing the heart to be under stress, probably led to a lot of people having heart attacks and strokes. Made things like your diabetes harder to control, made hypertension either harder to control or generated it in the first place.
Is there a direct link between sleep apnea and early heart disease?
Absolutely. And there's a direct link between sleep apnea and the onset of, say, heart attacks in the early morning hours. There's direct links with this. So it's less than, like I said, it's less than funny. And a lot of research has been into it. A lot of good data has been published. And now people, I think, are really acting on it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big flurry of articles in the last 5 years talking about metabolic syndrome, where there's a link between diabetes and high blood pressure and obesity and sleep apnea. And they all tend to prey on each other. They all, so to speak, gang up on you. And so doing things like taking care of sleep apnea may not cure your diabetes, but it can sure make it easier to control.
Interesting. So what kind of thing do you wear, Mark?
I wear a CPAP mask, which is fits over my nose and is strapped to my head. And then there's a 10-foot hose that attaches to the machine, which sends humidified air that I breathe all night.
Huh.
The only funny part is if you have to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, you just disconnect the hose, and you walk through the house with this 10-foot hose attached to your face. I think if I caught a look at myself in the mirror, I'd think I was some kind of science experiment. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. At one point, you probably were, if it was long ago. Our number is 800-486-8655. Is that something that's difficult to diagnose, this sleep apnea?
It depends. I mean, some people you could probably spot yourself in a crowd. They're the ones with the dark circles in their eyes. They're sitting in a business meeting at NPR, and they're, you know, nodding off, and they start snoring. Those people are probably pretty easy to spot.
Right.
The ones that may be more subtle, maybe somebody who's in their 40s, they're not heavy, they're not thin, they sort of look a little sleepy, and they've got some high blood pressure, you know, just flying under the radar. Or you get kids who do the opposite. We think in general children think life is interesting. They like to run around. They like to play. They like to be awake. They don't want to be asleep. So for them, when they are sleep deprived, they'll do the something of the opposite of what adults do. They'll start running around like crazy.
Hmm.
And it looks for all the world like hyperactivity. And what they're trying to do, they don't have access to cigarettes. They don't have access to caffeine. So they do the one thing that's available to them to stay awake, run around. But because they are sleep deprived, it's running around, but not without. But it doesn't have a lot of focus to it. It's not very constructive. And I think all of us who have kids have probably seen that before. We stay at a party. Things are going well. The kids are playing so nicely, and it's really late, but you really hate to go home. And so you stay a couple hours longer and then see what your kids act like.
Right. Right.
Not so good.
Yeah, right. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Elizabeth from Whitewater. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my phone
call.
My question is, I have a 16-month-old daughter, and she is generally quite good-natured, but very, very active. And I've been always, you know, since she was born, kind of following the advice of Mark Weisbluth, and I'm wondering if you're familiar with his work in sleep studies for children. And also, my second question to you is that she is currently kind of transitioning down to one nap a day, and it's been a rough few months for us where she's, you know, not able to really take her morning nap anymore, but is, you know, gets really kind of crabby in the morning and just barely makes it to her noon hour nap. I'm wondering if this is just something that we kind of have to go through and wait it out, or if you have any advice on something else that we can do to help her out.
Yeah, Dr. Weisbluth has written lots and lots of articles and books on the subject. He's one of the early leading authors in sleep in children. As far as your question about the 16-month-old transitioning, You make a very good observation that sleep isn't this simple, easy transition where you're an infant, so you take two naps, and then you get to be bigger, and then you take one nap, and then you don't take any, and everything's smooth. That's probably not the way it really works, is that she is going to pass through a period where she wants to be awake. Again, life is interesting, but there's this pressure to say, oh, maybe take a nap, maybe not. It is going to be a struggle. Some ways that can be done to overcome it is consolidate naps into one, but maybe make that one a little longer than it was before. That may help. It may help to, when you know that she used to take naps, say, in the afternoon, and now she's dropped that one, or the morning, whichever one it is, that you know there's going to be a natural period of time when she's going to be irritable. Don't put her in situations that require her to behave nicely. You know, deliberately take her out of those situations or plan for it at that hour and say that'll be a downtime. So even if it doesn't involve sleep, it involves maybe laying on the floor or sitting quietly in a chair, reading a book, something that's a little calm that will help with that period of time. And then once that's over, then go back to the regular activities.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. And the other thing is just really quickly, one of the other things I've been doing to compensate for this is to put her to bed earlier at night. So she goes down at 7 now instead of like 7:30. And Dr. Weisbluth kind of suggests that you can even go as early as 6, 6:30. But I'm a little bit fearful to do that because I'm afraid she'll be waking up at like 4 in the morning.
Right.
I don't know if that advice is something that I should try or...
I think you've got reason to be fearful.
Yeah, that's really...
You know, your brain's only going to require so much sleep per 24 hours. And if you change the arrangement such that you go to bed early, then the correlate is going to be you're going to get up early. I think that's you're absolutely correct. And I think the 7:30 is reasonable for someone that age. I think going to bed earlier is probably going to get just what you said. You're going to wake up earlier.
Thanks for the call. What do you think about naps?
Interesting topic, obviously, for what we just talked about with little children. It's a developmental thing. They will do it, and they do need it up to a certain point. And naps for the elderly, that's the other one they talk about, is this normal or not, say 65, 70 and older. And a lot of debate about it, but as far as we can tell, it's extremely common. So probably if it's common, it's probably normal to take a short nap in the afternoon. And it, in and of itself, it may not be a lot of concern, especially if the individual is awake and alert during the day. They take their nap in the afternoon. They wake up, they feel refreshed, and they go about the rest of their day fine, go to bed and fall asleep when they want. As long as all those things are true, then I don't make a lot of comment about a nap. If this is napping because I can't hardly stay awake and I wake up and I'm not refreshed from it, then I got concerned, or your naps are so long during the day it steals from the night sleep, then yeah, there's a problem. And I think that it's the way it is for adults, too. Our schedules are such, working adults, our schedules are such that we burn the candle at both ends. Eventually, you're gonna need to succumb to some sort of sleep pressure, and you take a nap during the day, which is fine, but you probably want to keep it short. Not enough to really make up for a lot of sleep, because if you do, then it rearranges your biologic clock, and now you're sleeping during the day and you're awake at night.
Right.
Now you just made the problem worse.
Yeah. So by short, you mean how long?
20 minutes or so.
20 minutes.
Just enough to take the edge off. Different maybe for someone who says has narcolepsy, then you might want to nap a little longer in the afternoon. You may need to make up the, for sleep, a lot of sleep pressure. That's different.
Yeah.
Disease states would be different. But just taking somebody that has none of those kind of problems, a short nap, just to take the edge off, would be fine.
We welcome more phone calls. Dr. Don Hardin is our guest, co-medical director of the Sleep Wellness Institute. And we're reacting, well, we're going beyond what the study is, but the CDC had a major study on sleep that was released yesterday and showed that people who sleep fewer than 6 hours a night, more than 9 hours a night, likely to be obese, and also showing a link to higher smoking rates, less physical activity, and more alcohol use. So we're talking about sleep. We'll be back to take more phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we return to your phone calls. We go next to Deborah. Hi, Deborah. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for the program. I always get my full 8 hours of sleep because without it, I do not function at all. The problem I'm having, though, is dreaming, and I don't know if you've addressed this yet or not. I just tuned in. My dreams are so vivid that they wake me up, and often I will wake up after a full 8 hours of sleep feeling like I haven't slept at all. And I was wondering if your guest could address that, and I'll take your comments off the air.
Do you remember all those dreams?
I do, and they're weird. They're very... Some of them are very, very bizarre.
Yeah.
I can recall them, and it's very bizarre.
Dr. Hardin.
I think, that's a really interesting topic for people to talk about. As we had talked about earlier, it appears that sleep has something to do with learning and memory, and REM sleep in particular has a big part in that. So these dreams that anybody has probably have to do with remembering or learning something from their day that was important and that they need to consolidate and keep it stored. We think dreams in general for most people tend to be kind of weird and bizarre. We think it has something to do with the fact that various parts of the brain start to activate during REM sleep, and whatever the memory it is that you're trying to store gets connected to other memories. And that's probably why the stories are so bizarre, is all these other memories get kicked up too. When it gets placed, so to speak, in its file, it gets placed in a bunch of other files. So dreams in general tend to be strange, especially the later in the night you go, the more strange they tend to get to be. When dreams go from being, boy, that was weird, and you kind of blow it off and say, well, that was weird, but that was a dream, to where it's disturbing, to where it says, hey, that bothers me. It bothers my sleep. It bothers me when I'm awake. I think about it.
that probably crosses a line. And I definitely think she should have that investigated either by her primary care physician or a sleep specialist, and to look for reasons why that would be so, especially things that may interfere with REM sleep. Sleep apnea would be a famous one. There may be other things too, depression, things like this that may interfere with dream sleep and cause these things to happen. And if for no other reason, if you say, gee, I know I sleep enough hours of sleep, or I suspect I do, yet I feel unrefreshed the next day, that alone is a reason to see somebody and say, what's the matter here?
Mm-hmm.
Either I have a lack of sleep. If you're sleepy, then there's either a lack of sleep or an increased need for sleep, one or the other. The other thing a physician will do is split out between what is sleepy and what is tired. Physicians tend to categorize them two different things. Sleepy, again, lack of sleep or excessive need for sleep, and fatigue can be due to all kinds of things, not necessarily sleep.
And thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Sandy from Algoma next. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Hey, great show. Your guest is dead on with this stuff. I wanted to go back to the sleep apnea part of it because I'm relatively certain that even as a child I had severe sleep apnea. I have many siblings. Nobody wanted to sleep with me because I was all over the bed. I was the most restless child that I knew of. In any case, and as an adult, I was 45 and I was diagnosed with severe obstructive sleep apnea to where I would stop breathing like 54 times in an hour. And each period of apnea would last 30 to 40 seconds. So, I mean, I was breathing a fraction of what people are supposed to breathe. And the part about the dreaming is right, too, because I would have the most vivid dreams, sometimes where I was underwater and I couldn't get to the top because, of course, I'm struggling to breathe.
Mm.
And since I've been on a CPAP, I've been on for about 2 years, I used to have a horrible, horrible depression to where I was suicidal. And I'm off my antidepressants. My life has changed dramatically. I can't even tell people if they have any problems with sleep or being tired all the time or, you know, and being depressed because of it, you know, to get checked because it's such a simple thing. And the change in my life, I just can't even begin to say how dramatic it was.
Mm, it sounds like it, Dr. Harden.
A couple points I want to make about that. You've got, as far as a physician goes, great teaching points. There have been plenty of articles published about the relationship between depression and sleep apnea and how one can affect the other. There have been other stuff published in psychiatric journals where individuals were given a diagnosis of depression and what they had was sleep apnea, a profound lack of sleep, quality sleep. And sleepy people and depressed people can look a lot alike. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. The other thing is there were some articles actually printed that talked specifically about people who were suicidal, especially elderly men, and they went through that, and that was the way they presented to the hospital. They had suicidal ideation, and they had plans and everything. I mean, it was very serious. Some of these individuals had sleep apnea, and when the sleep apnea was reversed, the suicidal ideation was reversed as well. So I'm not saying that they weren't depressed, but it sure is interesting that fixed their sleepiness and that kind of behavior disappeared. The other point you bring up about the dreams and such, again, things that will interrupt REM sleep, it doesn't have to be sleep apnea, but things that will interrupt REM sleep can give you some pretty bizarre dreams.
Thank you so much for the call. We have an email from Frankie. I'm a 56-year-old female with high blood pressure and atrial fibrillation, both controlled by drugs. My bladder functions were checked out as being fine by a urologist. Urologist had no recommendations for me. I exercise regularly and moderately physically active, and I work hard to reduce my weight. I do get tired during the day, and I can't help thinking that if I could sleep longer, my health would also be much better. Would going to a sleep clinic help me?
I missed the first part. You said atrial fibrillation and
high blood pressure.
And high blood pressure. I think those two things alone get you a sleep study.
Mm.
I mean, there's a high incidence of people who have atrial fibrillation, especially those that's hard to control. In other words, you do something to reverse it and it keeps coming back,
mm-hmm.
and sleep apnea. And it's one of the, it appears to be a trigger for it. So, and put that together with high blood pressure, I don't think there's much debate. You really ought to have a sleep state. Now, whether they find anything or not, it's a different story, but I sure would look very hard.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any doubt. You know, the articles on this, the publications on this are becoming very, very prominent, and I think your cardiologist, whoever you see about this, is probably going to be familiar with that.
We go to Anne, who's in Wisconsin, but is from Norwalk, Maine. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about medications used for sleep.
Yes.
Number one, are they safe to take long term? Number two, do they really give adequate sleep that is good for your health? And number three, is melatonin helpful to get sleep?
As far as long term goes, it's a split decision, yes and no. I mean, many of these things we can give out for long term, but the trouble is they can eventually lose their usefulness. Eventually, they won't work. So as far as long term goes, most people aren't on them long term because you need to switch to something else or get some sort of other therapy. Specifically speaking about insomnia, if that's what these are for, insomnia has, there are many different kinds, but in general, the short-term fix is a medication, a hypnotic, some sort of other medication to make you fall asleep quicker and stay asleep longer. And then the long-term tends to be psychotherapy, specifically some behavioral therapies that can be done to help you to sleep and stay asleep longer. That tends to be the, so to speak, the long-term fix. Melatonin, again, is not well tested, although it does, when what few experiments have been done, does appear to work. Keep in mind, it's not a fast-acting drug in general. It's kind of slow and steady. Bends your biologic clock in the direction you want it to go. So if you want to fall asleep early, you take it at the time you want to fall asleep, and as time goes by, you'll start to fall asleep closer and closer to that time.
Hmm.
That's what it's for.
Mm-hmm.
There was another question that I forgot.
Yeah, I think I did too, Anne. Was there another one here?
I think that's all. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much for your call. John from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I had a question that kind of goes along the lines of what some of the other callers asked. I'm a 23-year-old grad student in Milwaukee, and it's been a very tough semester, and I've noticed that, like, for example, last night I would get 7.5-8 hours of sleep, and I would wake up and feel very, very tired, and this would often trigger, I have medical migraines. So, you know, this lack of sleep that I shouldn't have, you know, I shouldn't be feeling would trigger a migraine headache. So I was wondering, is there anything, there's also a history of depression in my family. Is there anything that's correlated with that you might think, or what should I do to address this?
I guess the first thing I would do, hearing that you're a grad student, would be what are your hours in general? And if it's anything, you know, if it's even close to anything like undergrad, your schedule's going to be all over the place. Some
yeah.
days you're up late, some days you're trying to pull an all-nighter, sometimes you're with friends socially, sometimes you have nothing better to do but sleep and watch football all day on Saturday. And it because you're young and because you're tough, you can put up with that probably better than I could, but eventually it's going to wreak a toll on you, and the one it's going to do is your biologic clock. If your brain doesn't get a set wake-up time, and that's usually how you set your clock, is by what time you wake up, not what time you go to bed. So if your wake-up times are all over the place, then, yeah, it's going to trigger episodes where during the day or during a period when you want to be awake, suddenly you're going to be profoundly sleepy, and the reverse. Periods of time when you really want to be in bed, all of a sudden you're wide awake and can't sleep. Things that are related to lack of sleep, things like migraine triggers, the ability to control depression are going to be more difficult because of that. And again, it's a guess on my part without going through your schedule or what you do, but I would guess that if your hours are all over the place, it can potentially exacerbate those problems. One of the things you can do, although it's not particularly easy, is pick a wake-up time that will match no matter what day you're on. Pick that as your wake-up time and don't change.
Hmm.
The only trouble with that is it can make you maybe a pretty dull person. If you're having to get up early and then you go to bed early, you're no fun at a party. But
I'll trade the migraines for being dull, yeah.
One of the ways you might be able to deal with that or to get a good look at it is do something called a sleep log, where you write down what time you went to bed, and then the next day write down what time you think you fell asleep. Don't stare at the clock. That's going to give you a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But just estimate what time you think you fell asleep. Did you wake up that night? If so, was it brief or were you up for a while? What time did you get up the next day? And then what time did you actually get out of bed? Because sometimes those are two different things.
Right.
And then did you take any naps? And when you look at this, you can get a pattern of, gee, you know, I tend to be getting up late and staying up late. I'm a night owl. Maybe that's why at 4, you know, at 8 o'clock in the morning I get this big headache, because I'm used to getting up at noon.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We are plumb out of time.
Very good.
Thank you, Dr. Don Hardin, for being with us, co-medical director of the Sleep Wellness Institute. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Veronica Rickert will be here tomorrow. I'm going to be doing 40 work weeks for a little while here to get healthy again. So please welcome her tomorrow. She'll be on from 9 to 11. John Treader, thanks for on-air production. This is the Ideas Network.